This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Anthony Boza looks at crime from the perspective of 36 years as a cop. He rose through the ranks in New York to the position of police commissioner of the Bronx, which includes some of the most bombed out and dangerous urban areas in America. Then as deputy chief of the New York City Transit Police, he covered perhaps the most dangerous subway system in America. In 1979, he went to Minneapolis, where he served for 9 years as the police commissioner. He was known as a liberal reform commissioner, but he says his shakeups cost him the support of the force. Boza once joked to a Minnesota newspaper, morale had never been higher. The cops all hate their chief. Boza is retired from police work and now serves as Minnesota's gaming commissioner. He's written a new book about cops, crime, and the criminal justice system called The Police Mystique. He writes, until the overclass learns they're creating the muggers, rapists, druggies, and the murderers that terrify them, nothing much will be done to stem the tide of violence.
Look around you, 35 million people below the poverty level. We can now speak of a certain class warfare between the underclass and the overclass. Look at the homeless, the hungry, the unsheltered, the naked. Look at the streets of Philadelphia, New York, Chicago, Detroit, Cleveland, Minneapolis, Los Angeles, full of people from the underclass. The state does nothing about it. By the state, I mean the federal and state and local governments. We're not building housing. Welfare is out of the is a forgotten issue. The war on poverty has been declared lost and over. And the whole debate now centers on such issues as obsessed the 1988 presidential debate over Willie Horton. George Bush said, well, here is a black monster. Let's destroy him. Pandering to the worst racist instincts. And not to mention the fact that he had raped a white woman, just a wonderful symbol for him. And Dukakis basically agreed with it. He basically said that he would destroy that black monster a little more humanely. But the metaphor that works is, could George Bush and Michael Dukakis and Tony Boza be the Dr. Frankensteins that created this monster through neglect and indifference and hostility and racism and the disabilities of poverty that we visit upon the underclass?
Okay, so you have a social analysis.
Yes.
About how the poor get poor and stay poor.
A boring social analysis, we might say.
Well, what do you do with the social analysis on a day-to-day level when you're a police chief? I mean, you have to take action
on a
day-to-day level.
No, so, that's a good question. Yeah. You do exactly what the Vietnam generals did not do. The Vietnam generals fought the war, asked for more time, more treasure, more youth, and we'll take care of it, but they never informed us as to the backdrop, as to the reality, as to the moral issues and the consequences of their actions. They never gave us a thoughtful analysis. It was mindless, reflective activism, and it led to tragedy and defeat. The police chiefs have to fight that war. They have to make arrests, respond to calls for emergencies, issue traffic citations, put down riots. But then they have to report to us as to what they know when they see. Now, every police chief in the United States that I know of believes that summer riots are coming, long, hot summers. They see a combustible mixture of disaffection in the ghetto waiting for a spark. In Detroit, it was the NBA championship. The Pistons won the championship, and the ghetto residents decided to riot. Internally, we are disintegrating in poverty, criminality, violence, guns, drugs, an urban holocaust. And that's what's going to destroy the nation. And the police are basically irrelevant to crime. After all, we deal with Willie Horton only after he commits crimes. How about the upstream question? Where did he come from? How about prenatal care, abortion, sex education, his mother? How about the first 5 years of his life? To what degree do we nurture him or give him hope or give him education? Which is, I know what the listeners will be saying, their collective eyes will be glazing over with boredom and resentment and hostility. Oh God, another flaming liberal. But the reality is that I was a very tough law and order advocate, 36 years in three police agencies, 24 years with the New York City Police Department, the last four as Bronx police chief, then 3 years in the subway police, and that was an experience, and then 9 years as chief of police of Minneapolis. During this time, I was a very, very hard law and order advocate. I believe in capital punishment. I believe in incarcerating people. I believe in keeping the human animal under control. I believe very strongly in punishment. But I also believe in asking, where do they come from? And let's look at the upstream questions.
Probably one of the areas that has the largest underclass is the Bronx in New York, where you served as the chief of police. What are some of the unique things that you faced there as the head of police in the Bronx, do you think?
Racism, exclusion. It's interesting to see. These are people without hope. So the educational plant has given up. There are no jobs waiting, no homes, no marriage, no prospects. So they become warehouses. It's just the Bronx is America's frontier. That's where America is going to win or lose its battle for survival. And at the moment, it's losing.
People who are really poor have less to lose in a way. And there's this feeling of what can you do to me? You know, I have nothing anyways.
Yes, there is that. And you see that most dramatically in rioting situations where it's just pillage and burn and the Vandals and Visigoths are at the gate and it doesn't matter if you shoot or arrest or whatever and they burn everything to the ground. And if they have to the next day walk a mile instead of two blocks to buy milk and bread, they'll do it.
So how do you think that affects the relationship between cops and the people of a neighborhood if that neighborhood is really poor, as you call it, the underclass? Yeah.
The police are an army of occupation in the ghetto, doing the overclass's bidding to try to keep the underclass under control and out of sight. That's basically the assignment, the tacit assignment they have. That assignment is demoralizing to the police because it's tacit. It is not spoken. The police are told very clearly and affirmatively, arrest people, respond to calls, issue traffic citations. But they are told subliminally and very subtly, keep the underclass under control, keep them out of sight if you can, just take care of them, sweep them out of the way, and there's no way they can sweep them to, so that the police become demoralized by this awful assignment that they have been given, which is tacit.
My guest is Anthony Boza, and he served as chief of police in the Bronx and in Minneapolis, and he's written a new book called The Police Mystique. When you got to Minneapolis, did you think this was going to be a piece of cake after having come from the Bronx?
Yes and no. As an administrator, no. The administrative organizational problems that I faced were vast, were tremendous. The union was running the agency. The department was demoralized and screwed up. It needed to be shaped up. So it was an organization that was in total disarray. So administratively, I saw the problem as a very, very difficult and challenging one and one that I was not entirely sure I was up to. But the reality that the cop faces on the street is completely different. That is to say, the reality that the cop faces in the Bronx is very, very dangerous every single day in every way. Junkies, burglars, arrests, rapists, fires, riots, disorders, all kinds of problems. So it's a society in dissolution. The Bronx is dissolving before your very eyes and has been. I mean, when I saw the Minneapolis ghetto, it's really faded and not particularly great one-family houses with lawns and trees and space. I was really astounded. That sure wasn't the Bronx. So the reality that the cop faced on the street was very different. The administrative challenges that I faced were very, very difficult.
You've said that your main regret when you were a police chief in Minnesota was your inability to gain the affection of your troops.
Yes.
Why do you think you never got it?
Because I made a decision when I began as chief of police and had it as an executive always. You have to make a decision whether you're going to accommodate the comfort and convenience of your colleagues or whether you're going to serve the people. And if you serve the people, you're going to make your colleagues' lives less comfortable. They're going to work harder. They're going to confront more dangerous situations. They're going to work weekends. They're going to work summers. It's going to be a strain. And you're constantly forcing them to do things that are inconvenient or harsh or difficult. And that went on for 9 years, and their antipathy grew. And at the end, if anything, I had less affection from the ranks than I did at the beginning. I would only add in balance that the people of Minneapolis treated me with enormous affection. They treated me far better than I deserved throughout.
Why do you think it's mutually exclusive, serving the police and catering to the needs of the community?
Well, I like to deal in real politics, in the real world. And so Public figures today like to say a lot of bland things and have it every which way and have two number one priorities and all of that. The reality is that in my experience, and maybe this speaks to a paucity of wit or intellect on my part, I was never able to reconcile the two ideas of accommodating the comfort and convenience of my police colleagues and at the same time serving the people more effectively. I hired women and minorities. I reduced the upper rank levels really very dramatically by in the process deprived them of upward mobility. We went from 23 high-ranking officials to 12. I disciplined them very severely for acts of brutality and corruption. I broke up two-person patrols and made them one-person patrol. I held them accountable for the use of their powers. I constantly examined the use of their powers. It was a very open system. The press was able to crawl all over the department and ask anyone any question they wanted whenever they felt like it, a totally open system. It had a very, very unnerving effect on the troops, and they hated every moment of it, and I didn't know any way to reconcile. And I know that the temptation is to say, well, it can be done, it can be reconciled. In fact, I never found a way to reconcile the public interest with the comfort and convenience of my colleagues.
Let's talk about some of the typical dilemmas now in urban downtowns around the country and get your perspective as a former police commissioner of, you know, Minneapolis and the Bronx.
Right.
One of the great problems is homelessness now. There are, you know, people without homes.
Sure.
Many of them live in neighborhoods. Many of them can be seen living on vents, living on street corners in the downtowns of urban neighborhoods. Now, as a police commissioner, what did you tell your men about how they should treat the men and women who had no place to go and were living on the streets?
Man, what did I tell my men and women? I had plenty of women in policing today, whereas this was not always the case. Thank heaven for it. I think they've been a great addition. What I told them was to enforce the law and that not to do anything that was not legal. So we could not make them invisible. We could not move them about and displace them. Their rights had to be protected because the rights of the least are as important as the rights of the strongest. But that I would not tolerate public drunkenness or urinating on the sidewalk or importuning little old ladies on the street, and that they would be arrested and taken to detox centers, and that there would be strict accountability. There would be no public peddling because peddling is forbidden. No public begging because begging is forbidden. No public drunkenness. But it would have to be strict adherence to the law. If the law was not on the books, we were not to undertake any action. That is to say, no citizen may be touched or moved unless there is a legal reason for doing so. So I held the police very, very strictly to adherence to the law. That becomes a terribly important message to give to them, because if you're saying to them, get the people out of the way, make them invisible, move them off the streets, what are you really telling them? How do you move somebody off the street if you don't have the legal power to do so? So what I told them was to enforce the law. We would not allow structures that were illegal under our bridges, or public begging, or public drunkenness, or public hawking and selling of wares, or panhandling. And we did have a detoxification center to send them to. But the reality is that the government has abandoned the issue of creating a cheap, affordable housing. It has deinstitutionalized the mentally disturbed, many of whom ought to be institutionalized. We ought to have laws that permit the police to pick up someone that appears to be mentally disturbed to the point that it becomes a disturbance to those around them and taken to a psychiatric facility where they would be evaluated and possibly institutionalized involuntarily. Same with public drunks. We ought to be able to pick up public drunks on the street, take them to a detox center where they would be medically evaluated, dried up, cleaned up and sobered up and dried out, and then released up no longer than 72 hours thereafter, picked up involuntarily. We do that in Minneapolis. I just don't think we're addressing these problems. We're trying to sweep them under the rugs, and police chiefs who want to survive and want to remain on the payroll and collect salary and being told how wonderful they are every day and the emoluments of power and all of that, basically accommodate, rather hypocritically, what are fundamentally illegal orders.
I don't know if you've experienced this in Minneapolis, but something I've been seeing in Philadelphia And there's even been at least one newspaper story about this. It is a new kind of crime that seems especially pointless. For instance, breaking into a car, leaving the expensive cassette machine, but stealing a couple of quarters for the parking, you know, a couple of quarters that are in that little parking meter holder, you know, in the car. Breaking into a grocery store, leaving some of the money in the, leaving, you know, the money in the cash register, and taking a lot of Salem 100s, you know? Have you been seeing this kind of crime that seems to...
Yes, it's gratuitous, mindless vandalism and violence. And as our society moves deeper and deeper into this, this, you know, this division of classes and the plight of the impoverished and the poor, you're going to see them strike out mindlessly is the only word that comes to mind.
Do you have any sense of why there seems to be this new kind of particularly gratuitous crime where something more valuable is left and something really cheap or inconsequential is taken and at great risk to the person? My other question is, what can police do about it? Is this something that police feel especially helpless about?
Well, at great risk to whom? And certainly not to the perpetrator, because we've tripled the prison population and there's no room at the inn for anybody, so an arrest is a meaningless sanction. We have 1/4 of our black males under some form of criminal control in this society. The leading cause of death of black males in this country is murder. The black males represent 6% of our population and over 40% of our prison population. And we're talking about what people might call the black problem, which in reality is a white problem that we refuse to face. What have they got to lose? I mean, what's the risk of punching out a window and reaching in and picking up some loose change? Where's the risk in that? They get arrested, they get caught, but nothing happens to them. So there isn't any particular risk. So when you say, gee, they're taking a big chance, you might be taking a big chance because you have been conditioned differently through your education and training to think in a middle-class sense of the sanctity of property. But if you had been a teenage black male who conditioned to violence and exclusion and racism and hopelessness, it's no more than picking up a blade of grass.
I think one of the serious problems in a lot of inner city communities is that there's an incredible distrust of the police.
Sure.
This feeling that the police are there to, you know, to manage them, that a lot of the police are racist. And I wonder from your perspective as a former police chief, if you think racism in the police force in the cities that you've worked, Minneapolis and New York City, is a real serious problem. And if it is a problem, what you could do to...
This is a racist society. Why shouldn't its institutions be racist? Of course the police are racist. And they have enormous power. Very often they're not even held to account for its use. So you're going to see racism at its very worst. And their assignment is to keep blacks down, to keep them out of sight, keep them in their place. That's the assignment. I mean, what do you think the Willie Horton debate was all about? It was about keeping blacks down. It was about racism. It's a racist society.
You say that the police, out of necessity, tend to stereotype.
Absolutely.
What do you mean by that?
Well, the average cop has got to deal with 10 to 20 separate incidents every single day, very quickly. So he's got to, or she's got to, sort of size it up, make a decision, and act on that decision. 99 times out of 100, they will be right, but they will make mistakes. When they make mistakes, they're tragedies. That's the trouble, and that's the problem. But they will assess the attitude. Attitude is critical. The police are really giving you an attitude test, and if they size you to them, there are only, you know, there are citizens and there are jerks. And if they define you as a jerk, that's not the phrase they use, something a little less delicate than that. If they define you as a jerk, you're in trouble. So they pull you over, they have to make a snap decision. They stop you on the street, they see you running, they're responding to a burglary, three people run out of a house, they've got to size you up. If it's three little old ladies with blue hair and fur coats running out of the house, that's one thing. If it's three black 15-year-old boys with sneakers, that's a different issue. They stereotype all the time, and they have to, and there's no way to avoid it, and all you can do is tell them to be cautious, not to overreact as they stereotype, but they must stereotype. Everyone does anyway.
Let me ask you, through your years as a police chief in Minneapolis, your wife was arrested several times for...
Six times.
For civil disobedience in anti-nuclear protests.
Yeah.
What effect did that have on you? Did the men on your force rib you about that, or...
Erica was arrested six times. She's a tremendous peace activist, a great believer in causes, and went to jail twice. And as far as I was concerned, I felt like Mrs. Mahatma Gandhi must have done. You know, I mean, Mahatma's up to his usual madness, and I just learned to live with it. I didn't much care what the cops felt. I got to be chief of police to do it my way, not their way, so I wasn't worried about what they felt.
Do you think it's harder now to be a cop than it's ever been before?
Yes, because of that subliminal message of keeping the underclass in its place. Before it was very straightforward. Make arrests, respond to calls, give tickets. Now they're being told, keep the underclass out of sight. The blacks, the homeless, the hungry, the naked. Keep them out of sight. We don't want to be bothered with them, but we don't have the laws to deal with them, and we don't have the institutions, but just keep doing it. That makes it very, very demoralizing and difficult. It's very ambiguous.
Are you glad to be off of the force now?
No. I loved what I did. I was grateful for it. Like Herman Melville, the police world was my Harvard and Yale. Loved every minute of it. Served as well as I could for 36 years. But 36 years was enough, and I got out of the way because I was in the way.
Anthony Boza. His new book is titled The Police Mystique. He's now Minnesota's gaming commissioner. Boza appears in the documentary film Police Chiefs, which will be shown on the PBS series POV during the week of July 31st. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.